In this episode, I sit down with my friend Bobby Lacking. He is a senior vice president of a local state chartered bank. Now, we had fun discussing his background, our relationship, even collateralizing a life insurance policy in light of Nelson's third rule, don't do business with banks outside of savings and checking, i.e. don't be dependent upon third-party lenders. I'm telling you, I had fun and learned some things. Hope you enjoy listening. Welcome to the Bank Your Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery. And I'm, you know, as you know, if you're a regular listener, I'm always very excited when people have the opportunity and the ability to come in live to the studio. And that's what we have today. Look, I have a friend of mine who is a local banker, and he is a banker of mine. I mean, we have done business in the past. And so when it comes to, you know, banking with life, the infinite banking concept, everybody wants to beat up the banker, and which is really the central banks around the world, not the local banker. But this guy's a salt of the earth guy. I dearly love him. And, you know, he agreed to come on and share his time. So, yeah. Bobby Lacking, tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Absolutely, James. So, thank you for having me very much. I've known James here for about 10 years now, probably going back, banked him on and off, and very nice things you said about me there, James. I appreciate that. I had the same comments about James. He's a salt of the earth guy as well. My personal background, I've been in banking my whole entire professional career since I was 20, just turned 38 March 2nd. So 18 years now. I've kind of teed my banking background in the community banks. Started off at a small bank, been at three separate banks. All of them have been fairly small. Did have a little bit of activity with a bigger bank, about a $14 billion bank. They were owned out of Nebraska. And I'm currently right now at Grandview Bank, and we've opened up a branch in Burleson, Texas, which is kind of local to where James is here in Alvarado. And we've got five locations, about $600 million in total assets. So we're fairly small in the niche of banking. And as James alluded to, we're definitely a community bank where we service the local community. We do a lot of mom and pop business, but we can also do some larger commercial style deals as well. Our owner's local. He lives in Fort Worth. We're owned by one guy, and he's been wonderful since he bought us in 2017. And prior to that, I was at National Bank of Texas, which is where I met James, actually, and they're based out of Fort Worth. So both local banks. That's kind of my background. So I've got some background with the corporate side of banking, but I don't like it. I wouldn't work for a corporate bank. I work for a small bank, just like a lot of local guys like to bank at a small bank for the same reasons. Local management at the level when you walk in, somebody can make a decision. You don't have to climb the ladder and call somebody in New York City. So that's kind of my background in banking. I've been various aspects of the bank. I've been in analytics. Started off as a teller, did collections, did special assets, got into loan analytics, did some analyst work, got into junior lending, and now I'm doing commercial real estate primarily, but I can do anything on the commercial lending side or consumer lending side that you need.
Well, what's junior lending? Does that mean you make a loan, but you
junior lending is like they call you a lender, but you can't make any loans unless you ask somebody for permission. Yeah. That's kind of what a junior lender is, but they start you off. They're not sure if you can make loans or not, so they keep your authority low.
Sure.
So as you get higher and you get advanced, they give you more authority as you get.
Are you going to make them money or are you going to lose the money?
Yeah, are you making money or losing money? How kind of past dues do you have? That kind of stuff. But it's a fun career. It's been good to me.
Yeah,
I met a lot of good people, like James being one of them, through the career.
So. I appreciate that. Yeah, you said 18 years, or no, we've known each other about 10 years.
Sure.
And I've kind of alluded to you. I've never named you by name, you know, in previous podcasts, but I've talked about different things that, you know, we've talked about. So here's a little background. So my dad banked at Everman National Bank.
Okay, yep.
South Fort Worth. Everman is right south of Fort Worth, Texas. And a gentleman named Paul was a teller at that bank, and I'm a kid, and you know, I met the bankers too. But then Paul, he went on to become a banker, and I kind of followed Paul around because he would go from bank to bank, and great guy. He moved on, passed on. He graduated several years ago, but and I really liked him because, you know, at the time I really needed a bank and bankers. And he would always say, you know, if I ask for something, he'd always say, well, let me see how I can get it done. Sure. It was never, you know, it was like, and he always got it done. So I don't know how profitable he was for the banks that he worked at, but
great guy. I love Paul. It's funny you mentioned that. So Paul actually was where I met you.
Yep.
So I inherited Paul Wethington, can I say his last name? Paul Wethington's portfolio whenever I met James. And I knew Paul somewhat. My dad had done some business with Paul, kind of like you did, on and off. Paul was a wonderful guy. And I think he was probably the core of what we call today as a community banker. Because he was true and true. He cared about his customers. He would do anything he could to help you succeed. And he had probably one of the best knacks for character I had ever seen. Like, he knew when you walked in the bank, he could tell you within 5 minutes if he was going to loan you money or not.
No way.
And he was very good knack for character. That's just kind of where he was. And that's really where community bankers come into play. You're not just on paper. You know, you're talking to somebody one-on-one like we're talking here. And to have that ability, that's a talent to have, and nowadays it's not noticed as much. But Paul
makes me feel good. He never told me no.
Paul's a great guy. Yeah. So, but I inherited his loan portfolio actually when I was at National Bank, and he had a really good loan portfolio. He had some, just like anybody, everybody's got their, I guess, C students, I guess you would call them.
non-performing
loans. But Paul had a really good rapport with most of his customers, and he knew them very well. And I inherited his portfolio. And shortly after I took over, Paul was pretty sick and ended up passing away, like James referenced there. And his wife's still local, and she does business with me. And so his customer base was kind of, I think, a shot for me and my career to the next level, because I had a following, but luckily, Paul and I apparently were a lot alike. So I don't know. I never knew Paul real, real well, but it sounds like him and I kind of operate the same way, because I just kind of fit right in with his customer base. So it worked out well. And a lot of those customers today have followed me to where I'm at now. So it's pretty interesting.
Well,
I love that.
You know, you got gray
hair, Paul.
Yeah, you got gray hair now. But back when we met, it was blonde.
And this gray hair is because of James.
It's like trying to lend me money, and I keep saying no.
James is very rate conscious, which he should be. I think we're going to get into some of that here in a little bit, because you got to be smart about what you're borrowing.
Yeah.
So if you use a bank for funds.
I think, legitimately, I believe everybody should have a good, strong relationship with a local community banker or smaller bank in your town. I mean, I believe that. My daddy told me a long time ago, he's like, James, you got to allow the banker to make money. Well, you know, I heard it and understood what it meant, but, it was – I didn't think I needed bankers back then.
Yeah. My dad was the same way. So you need three people in life. You need a banker, a doctor, and a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Make sure you have all three of those in your back pocket. And I've got two of those now. I don't really go to the doctor, but I've got a lawyer and a banker. It's hard being a banker to have a banker as well, because you'd be surprised. You'd think bankers are enemies, but they're actually not. Most bankers are pretty, and James knows this, we're all friends, and we send deals to each other, and it's not a cutthroat type industry anymore. It used to be, where it's not so much now. It's kind of like James alluded to originally. It's kind of the small guy versus David versus Goliath, almost, where the community bankers really kind of huddle together, and we're friends, and we're kind of pushing back away from the corporate banking philosophy that's pushing on us nowadays, because we don't like it either. You know, a lot of people group us in with Chase Banks and the Wells Fargos, and we're completely different. We operate differently. We're privately owned, so we don't have to adhere to shareholders that are conformed to the Chase and the Wells Fargo way of banking. So it makes a big difference.
Wells Fargo,
that's exactly right.
I didn't know
I had an account there until the other day. Apparently, I've got four. I didn't know that.
No kidding.
I had four accounts there, not getting any interest on any of them.
Yeah, but somebody's getting a spiff off of it.
Somebody's getting an account per account fee on that deal.
Yeah, and whoever sold it, my youngest son Jake worked there.
Sure,
and he's good, you know. And he made his bonus. He didn't know what he was doing, you know what I mean, but he's.
Yeah.
Well, you do it long enough, then you figure out, it's like, no, this isn't okay with what's going on. So he left a couple of years before all that came out into the news.
And what Wells Fargo has, they're just so big. Their network is massive. If you travel, you know, they've got banks in every state almost. They're just networks huge. They have extremely deep pockets to throw into their tech industry. And that's where banking is moving toward tech. And that's why it's harder for community banks to compete, because the requirement for technological advancement on the app, website, banking in general is used to when we grew up, you know, and I'll put myself in that because I'm an old soul. But I used to go into the bank, you know, and I like to go in and I want to talk to the person I'm doing business with. The lobby traffic at community banks has probably fallen off 50% in the last 10 years, and maybe more than that. Our lobby traffic is not where it's at. If you don't have a direct communication with your customer like James and I mean, if we need something, we're texting or I'm calling him on the phone. He's not coming into my office to talk every day because he's busy. I'm busy. You know, it just... Times have changed. So
that reminds me one time I think it was an automobile loan with Paul at National Bank. It was actually Texas Bank before that. Or that bank had been purchased so many times and Paul stayed with it. Anyway, I had an automobile loan and I called Paul one day and I said, Paul, you know, I'm late on that payment, you know, but I'm going to, you know, I got it and I'm going to bring it down. And this was probably 25, 30 years ago.
Wow.
He said, it was a long time. He said, James, you know, he said, this bank, like most banks, have a drive-through window. They got a night deposit box. And I never forgot that.
He gave you the what for, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He don't want no excuses.
Yeah. And I was just letting you know I was late, but I was bringing it, you know.
And very few people do that. So I'm sure he loved the fact that you called him.
You know, but since then, I probably used the night deposit box 10 times more than I've ever walked into a bank.
Sure, yeah. And that's just because the time of day you come or whatever it is, and you've got other things going, so you maybe don't want to have 30 minutes for a conversation if you walk in, too. So, yeah, that's funny you said that.
I remember when we met, I believe I was in the lobby at what is now National Bank.
NBT Financial, I believe is what they're calling now. So,
just rebranding. So,
great bank, great bank. Got a lot of good friends still there.
Yeah, we still bank there.
Sure,
But you introduced yourself, and you know, I'm grateful that you did. And I mean, I'm just telling you, I'm not trying to embarrass you at all.
No, you're good. I appreciate the plug.
And you know, it's like, I'm Bobby Lackey. And, you know, so I was part of, I think, Paul's, I was Orphans, right?
Sure.
That went with Paul's clientele. And here I'm this young man's introducing himself to me, and you looked about 14 years old.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. I get that a lot.
And you said, y'all have been in banking 8 or 9 years. And I'm like doing the math in my head. I mean, I'm pretty good with numbers. I know I could be better, but anyway, so that's what I remember from us meeting. And then,
well, that's awesome. Well, I'm glad you said that. You never told me that before. So that makes me feel good. I try to make good first impressions if I can. So
you did
do my best.
Yeah. And then since then, you know, I mean, we bank with y'all and we bank with some others, but, and I don't know how much I've talked about this on the podcast, but remember about, I think it was around 2016, maybe 2017. So Paul had been gone. And my wife and I, we have a little home. We had a little home here in Johnson County. And we were going to build a pool. So we knew that where we lived is lovely. We'd been there for, you know, 10, 15 years. But we knew that we were going to move. And we were looking for where we wanted to move. And the house needed to be remodeled. And while we were looking, you know, we thought, well, we should, you know, like build a pool.
Yeah.
So we're enjoying the time that we're going to remain here, and it needs to be remodeled if we're going to sell it when we buy another home. Do you remember when, because, and I even had this conversation with Nelson Nash, and in my mind, you know, I'd already done a couple of cash out refis, my wife and I, on that property, and we paid life insurance premium into the PUA. And so I concocted this big idea because I create a model, you know, it's like an educational model that I would take it. I would do a cash out refi, pay the PUA premium, and then collateralize that policy and finance the pool.
I do remember I do remember that. Actually, you kind of schooled me on that because I had been new to this whole industry on the life insurance banking. And I'm a banker, but I listen to James's concepts and I fully agree with what he does. I think he's onto a really great concept, very intelligent when it comes to life insurance. But you kind of schooled me a little bit on that because he brought me this proposal in. It was probably better than anything I had seen in loan committee in probably 2 years. So I'm like, you want a job first? And he said, no. So I said, well, let me take this proposal to my boss at the time. And I mean, he had this structured with life insurance as an equity versus using his real estate. I think that might have been where you were going.
Well, sorry to jump ahead. That's kind of where I'm going. Yeah. But, you know, I decided, you know, not to do it. So Nelson Nash, my mentor, dear friend, you know, God rest his soul. You know, he had four fundamental rules for practicing the infinite banking concept. You know, high premium, high cash value. And number one was to think long term. Think long range.
Smart.
Right. Number 2 was don't be afraid to pay a premium. Don't be afraid to capitalize, i.e. pay a premium. Mm-hmm. And then number 3 was don't steal the peas. If you borrow against your assets, if you borrow against life insurance, you can't go anywhere in the free world and get a loan without a loan repayment. And you should be an honest banker. Don't steal the peas, right?
Absolutely.
And then the 4th one was don't do business with banks outside of savings and checking. Mm-hmm. And then he added another one later on that said rethink your thinking. Okay. So and here I'm going to Nelson Nash. I'm gonna do a cash out refi. I'm gonna be dependent upon the lender, right? And then I'm gonna do the premium payment to the policy, and then collateralize the policy to build the pool, and you know, build the model, make it like really a nice, decent educational type presentation. This is one thing that can be done, and this is how I did it. And I went through all that, but I didn't create the PowerPoints and finalize the module that I was wanting to create. Mm-hmm. But then I said, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. You know, so what we actually did is we used a policy on my wife.
Correct.
And the reason was, in that particular company at that time, they were saying you couldn't do first-year loans. The agents were saying, well, you can't do a first-year loan on that company, which was not true.
And that's through the policy the policy that they sent to your wife.
That's the policy that we owned, the life insurance company, right? Gotcha. The agents of that life insurance company were saying that you couldn't do first-year loans with that company.
The agent, I see.
Right, which is just not true.
Right.
You could, in fact, do first year policy loans, but if you didn't want to, because they would reduce the agent's commission or something like that, I believe is what it was. So the agents didn't want their clients taking first year loans. Yeah. That was, I think it was in the first year. It would have been toward the end of the first year of that policy. And what we did is we took that policy. I called you and said, hey, Bobby, do you lend against life insurance as collateral? And you said, well, I think so, mm-hmm. but I think it has to be a particular kind.
Type of policy, correct.
And I said, this is that kind. Mm-hmm. And then we met showed the policy, the illustrations and what have you.
And you actually taught me some of this. So it's very similar to loaning against your retirement assets. So banks can loan against equities, like if you have stocks or bonds or anything. We can't loan against retirement investments, but we can loan against stocks, bonds, premiums, and really the life insurance falls into the same category. And I've learned that over the years because it's became a really popular model for securing loans, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And the bank looks at it as almost a cash secured loan. So you can get a really good rate on these, having a bank underwrite it using the life insurance policy as collateral. And I had never done one, believe it or not, until I met James as far as actually securing a loan with a life insurance policy. I didn't even know if it could be done, to be honest. I think that's probably why I'm like, I'm not sure. I think we can. I had done some private equity asset loans secured by stocks, bonds, treasury, T-bills, that kind of stuff, which has become very popular nowadays too. But I had never done one with the life insurance policy. After I did this with James, I probably ended up doing a dozen more over the course just from various people because I was pitching it to them. Yeah. It's like, hey, do you have a life insurance policy? And they're like, well, yeah, what does that mean? I'm like, well, we can actually take that as collateral. And I don't know if you know this or not, but you actually taught me avenue to loan against. And a lot of people have that. Yeah. They may not have an asset or it's pledged or they've got debt on it. They don't want to refinance the whole deal, but they've got life insurance. But it's got to be a specific policy. Yeah. And you
whole might life, that. Not whole universal life.
It has to be a whole life policy. Yeah. But the banks look at it like a cash secured policy. So you can get a really good rate. So for anybody out there that's looking at doing something on a loan, just know that that is definitely a player. Any bank that I know of right now would consider that a tier one loan, which is a good asset loan because it's cash secured.
And so that's the equivalent of the individual owning the policy. That should be their tier one capital, in my opinion. And then they're going to collateralize that at the bank. But see, as interest rates go up in the big wide world, of course, loan rates do at the commercial bank or the community bank. Well, they also go up at the life insurance company, you know, and different life insurance companies, they do things different way. But basically and fundamentally, rudimentary, there's a fixed rate loan from a life insurance company or a variable rate loan. So there is a often windows of time that you can play arbitrage if you wish.
What's your right now and what you're selling, like what's your primary like length of term? Like, are you looking at 20, 25 years primarily on whole life? Or do you see 30, 40, 50, like not whole life, but like premium policies where they're,
yeah, well, they kill that, out? In my opinion, you should have the contractual right to pay as long as possible, but not the obligation, which I know that's very broad, but you know, a 20 pay life, paid age 65, paid age 100, a 30 pay life. If the policy structured, what I consider to be correctly, it will have enough cash value to be able to offset the premium. So when a policy structured, maybe I have a paid to 100 policy, but if I'm structuring the policy, you know, within all of the tax ramifications, the MEC limits, modified endowment contract limits, I'm not violating anything, you know, through the tax code, but I have a strong policy. It has an appropriate death benefit because that, number one, you know, we can practice banking, we can do whatever we want, but if you have a family and you have obligations once you leave, you should have a death benefit, in my opinion. How much? It's, you know, between you and your professional to work that out. But beyond the death benefit, then we're solving for cash, right? Sure. How much cash can I accumulate, you know, consistently, systematically, without jeopardizing the integrity of a policy through structure? You know, if I artificially make too much or really, really high cash value in year one, I mean, I might have access to that, but I'm going to cause potential problems in the future. There's just no doubt about that. So I would say directly to your question would be, you want the contractual right to pay as long as possible, but you want the ability to be able to offset the premium after 7 years, 10 years, 15, depending on the individual.
And some of these that are earning interest, I mean, they're better models than anything a bank would offer. I mean, and you've pitched these to me before, and I don't know if I fully understood that until we became friends on what you can earn interest wise on some of these whole life policies.
Yeah. And you know,
they're even paying for the premium. I mean, it's a better model than putting money in a bank CD or whatever have
you. You know, and there's, you know, there's two fundamental ways that cash value accumulates in a whole life policy. If it's a mutual company, you receive dividends, right? So there's one, the dividend's non-guaranteed. And if it's paid into the policy, the paid-up addition derider of a policy, it's going to cash by an additional death benefit, right? Paid-up additions. And then you have the base or just a straight whole life policy, whether it's paid to 30, 100, or what have you. Mm-hmm. We can all calculate an interest rate increase, you know, a rate of increase within that base policy, but fundamentally the cash value in the whole life policy must equal the face amount at age 100 or age 120. All right, the older policies were written to age 100, now they're written to 120 years. So that cash value is going to meet the increasing face amount because the dividends are buying additional death benefits, so the death benefit is increasing. But so that cash value must, by contract, guaranteed contract, must equal the face amount at age, you know, 120 if you go buy a policy today. So there's two components to that: the dividend accumulation and then the increase in the cash value of the base policy. And so, and I say that because when you use the word interest rate, you know, we can calculate an interest rate if we have, you know, the present value, the future value, you know, the time, and then, you know, we can all calculate the rate of return or the interest rate on that. And I'm only spending time here because a lot of people, it's quite often in the infinite banking world that it's like, well, this policy earns 5%. Well, we can calculate an interest rate, right? But I prefer to use an internal rate of return because the accumulation is a combination of a guaranteed increase and then a non-guaranteed dividend, right? So if you have premiums going in and a death benefit paying out and a time period, or you get mad and quit and you surrender the policy, you know, then we can calculate an internal rate of return. Then therefore, then we can compare life insurance to other assets if we wish, because a mutual fund or an investment account, they're going to have a different time period, a different cash flow. You know, if I go buy a bond portfolio, I'm putting money in, but I'm receiving bond interest, you know, and then I'm going to take the bond and sell it eventually. So the cash flows in and out are separate, just like a real estate portfolio. Mm-hmm. They would have, you know, I might buy a house and keep it for 6 months and sell it. I might buy and hold one. I might buy and keep one for 9 months. The cash flows in and out are different. But if we have the time period and the cash values, or the cash flows and the starting value and the ending value, then we can calculate an internal rate of return, and then therefore we can compare asset class to asset class.
I love
class.
That. Exactly. And on a personal financial statement, speaking of what you're just saying, banks will calculate cash value on a financial statement. They won't calculate the actual the life insurance policy unless it's cash value. Yeah, the death benefit's not calculated.
That's right.
But the cash value is. So that's a loser what you're saying. The cash value is where it's at. And if you calculate that internal rate of return,
it's good.
You really, and you're smiling because it can really be a big number. You can make a lot more through that than you could just a standard traditional certificate of deposit or an IRA or a 401k, and those are all good things.
Yeah.
But what you're saying, if you've got the ability to do it and you know how to understand it, because I think a lot of people, and that's what I love about your podcast, you explain it in layman's terms to people that may have the ability to do it but don't understand it.
Yeah.
And that's the key. But if you've got the ability to do it, understand what James is saying here, because it really could be a huge wealth factor for you over the 20-30 year span. It's a long-term investment, just like a lot of real estate investments are, but it's everything long-term. Nowadays is long-term for the most part. You just got to minimize your risk and maximize your gain.
Well, that's kind of the thing about, you know, thinking short-term. I think, and God bless everybody listening, I love you, nothing but, you know, love, peace, and chicken grease. Most Americans can't think past next week.
Sure.
Yeah, well, next month.
So busy, we're caught up in this bubble, and we live here, and then you think about something at, you know, laying in bed at 10 o'clock at night, like, man, I should have did that. And then you forget about it the next morning. So we're just so busy with our schedules. It's, you got to understand, because there's loopholes with everything, right? You know, I mean, there is. Not that this, like you said, it's not doing anything wrong. It's just if you understand the loophole, man, you can come out way better in the long run if you understand it. It's like taxes. Yeah. Like, you understand loopholes in filing taxes, you know, you can, you know, you make your life a lot easier. We all pay taxes, right? But we try to minimize it as much as we can. And Uncle Sam gets enough of our money as it is.
Oh my gosh!
Right, don't get started on that, right?
Threat of, you know, force.
Threat of force, exactly. Well, I love listening to you talk about that, because you still school me on a lot of that stuff outside of the banking, because it's so much different than banking.
People
don't realize it. Yeah. It is a banking concept, but it's really, it's a totally different aspect to what we do on the daily and traditional banking.
Yeah, no question.
And that's why it intrigues me so much, because I love to listen to it. Because it's really I think an unknown factor to a lot of people.
It really is.
In your world, it's probably not, but to the masses, I feel like people just don't understand the concept. They're not educated on it as much.
Well, that's why I get up every day pushing back the frontiers of ignorance or expanding the frontiers of knowledge.
Sure.
You know, people just don't know, and that's the whole idea behind this effort in this podcast, is to expose to you, the listener, that it is possible for you to control the banking function at the you and me level. You actually can become your own banker. Does that mean you're going to get rid of the local community banker? No, not at all. But you can control that banking function.
Sure can. You can call and tell him what you want, kind of like what we do here. You kind of control your destiny. So James calls me, you know, when he asks me for something, I ask him when he wants to come and sign. You know, it's like, when do you want to be in the sign? Because he already understands it. You know, he's already underwritten the deal for me. He understands the bank. He could be a banker easily. It's very similar in concepts, but the overall dynamic of what you're doing is different, but you understand both sides. And I think what you mean by be your own banker, a lot of times I've seen several of your videos, is be in control of your own destiny with your own financial strength. Because you know, if you're dependent on somebody telling you yes for a loan, you're in the wrong spot. You need to make sure you're coming to that banker. He wants your business because he knows you know what you're doing. You got your stuff together. So you got two or three banks biding for your business. That's what I feel like you mean by be your own banker. You know, you still need a local banker because you got to move money in and out. You're going to need, you may need loans in the future. You're going to need a mortgage. You're going to need a car loan possibly, or you may pay cash for it. That's great. But at least you got that option there if you need it. And I'm like you, and I'm not tooting my horn, but I would deal with any local bank over a big bank by far. They're just a lot easier if wherever you're listening, you know, if you're in Wyoming, if you're in California, if you're in New York, I know you're probably not local in Texas, but find a local bank there. Deal with the local guys, because they're the ones that are going to go to bat for you, not these corporate banks.
Amen. Well, do you remember in that conversation that we had back to my wife's policy? And I mean, I'll move on, but do you remember me saying, hey, if you, and because we did have the conversation about some life insurance companies reduce a dividend when there's an outstanding loan. And back then, interest rates are really low.
Three and a quarter, I believe, prime was at the time, 3.5. It was not where it's at now, at 8.5.
I'm like, yeah. Bobby, you need to go find some of these agents out here because they've got clients that would collateralize their policies
quick.
And yeah. But I also said, Bobby, if you ever do a loan on a policy and they default on the loan, I'm a buyer of that
policy. Buyer of that policy. I didn't even know that was a thing until James started telling me, like, what do you mean you're a buyer? How do you buy? He's like, oh, you do it this way. And he kind of explained it to me. And again, ignorance is bliss, right? If you don't understand, you don't understand. So you've taught me a lot about the insurance game. But I do remember the conversation with your wife's policy.
So all those 12 that you've done the lending on, or roughly 12, they've all performed?
They all perform perfectly. Because most of the time, if somebody's educated enough to understand what they're doing, loaning on, they've got other assets. But they're trying to find the best avenue, the cheapest avenue for them to get that money. And none of it has been specifically, it's always been like, for instance, you want to go build a pool, or instead of doing a second lien and paying a bunch of closing costs on your house, you use the policy. You have no closing cost. It's very minimal. We don't charge origination fees because it's non-real estate. It's the cheapest model to get into that money that you could possibly have, other than cash securing it, which what's the point there? I mean, you've got cash, so unless you just want to keep it for a rainy day fund. But no, it's a beautiful model. So they've all performed. Most of them have been, I would say, higher net worth individuals, because that's the reason they have the policy. In case something were to happen to them, they've got their kids taken care of, wife taken care of, whatever the case may be. So in most cases, when you see somebody that's got a high value cash policy, they generally have a higher net worth, or they're responsible, they're conservative, they've got cash in the bank, they've
love
got assets,
family.
They love their family. They're good people, you know, they're good down to earth people that care about what's going to happen to them and their family. So you see that a lot of times, and that goes back to one of the C's of banking, which is character. So having a life insurance policy is good, but it also shows character on your part, taking care of your family, which is a huge aspect to local bankers and corporate bankers, even though they tell you it's not, it is. You know, they look at just what a credit report's for. You know, they're looking at your character. They want to see, have you paid that bill? Well, you know, it may not be the best. We've got a reason for it. That's why I'm a big advocate of looking at credit history versus your score. I don't look at score. I never look at score until I've looked at the history. I want to see how you've paid your bills. A lot of times in the world we live in, everything's based off a computer algorithm, right? Like it looks at a model and it grades you based off availability on credit card, revolving debt. How have you paid? How long's the history? Have you had a debt more than 10 years? It's looking at a lot of different factors to grade you on that credit score. Credit scores are all over the place. There's three different bureaus. You got Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. Sorry to get off topic here, but it's kind of tying into what you're saying. Like,
you're looking at
credit history, but if you look at the history versus the score, you may have a 650 that walks in, which is not really a great score anymore nowadays. It used to be middle of the road. You need to be over a 720 to do anything hardly.
What are the credit scores? I mean,
so like your minimum, you got tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier one is typically 720. Some banks are 740 plus. So anything over 740 is going to get you your tier one on right now on a mortgage loan. If you're over 800, that's great. It's not helping. You could be a 742 or an 815. You're going to get the same rate.
I got you.
So, but the higher the better, obviously, you know, with anything.
What is the top end of the?
Top tiers, you can go up to 900. I've never seen one over 850. So it goes to 900, they say. But I've seen them 860, 870. Might have been you, actually. I don't know. but anyways.
I do not care what my credit score
sorry
is.
Sorry to say your credit score on live air here, but I'm just kidding. No, it's good. But you got to make sure your credit history is good. You may see an 800 walk in that's got two credit cards, they just have no revolving debt on it. You may not see one that's 800, but you may see a 750 that way, because you got to have multiple factors to get to 800. But you may see like a 22-year-old that walks in that's had two credit cards. He's been on with his mom since he was 18, and she's got great credit. She pays her bills. The revolving availability is low, meaning he's got a lot to bid on, or a lot he could borrow on versus what he has against it. He may be a 750 credit score. Well, he wants to buy a $600,000 house.
Ooh.
Okay, this kid's performed great on two credit cards that have a $10,000 balance.
Right, and wants to
borrow $650. He's never performed on a six, but his credit score's high.
Right.
So if a computer's looking at this model, they're probably going to approve him for a loan because the computer's looking at the credit score.
Oh.
Not always. They build other factors in. Like if you go do a mortgage, they'll build factors in. They want to see mortgage history. But if you go apply for something, you're going to get approved for anything because you're over 740 credit score. But if I look at that, I'm like, well, this kid, he's trying, he's doing good, but he's never been, he has no history. Yeah. So in
10,000
mortgage,
far cry from 650.
Exactly. So, and nowadays, you know, a starter home's $400,000 here in Texas. I don't know where everybody else is at, but the real estate values have just went nuts over the last 15 years here. It's, if you own property 15 years prior, you're sitting on a pretty good asset right now because it's appreciated naturally by probably 40 to 50%. And you've seen that.
Or 100, 150%.
Some of them have been over 100%, which is incredible. But you got to look at all those factors. Because if you look at somebody that's, you know, that's got a lot of history, for instance, flip that equation, and they're a 680 credit score, they've got two mortgages they've paid off, never missed a beat. They've got four car loans they've paid off, never missed a beat. We call those your core debts. So they may have a medical collection on there because their wife went to the hospital and their insurance didn't pay it. This bumped their score down. Well, to me, I'd rather have that 680 than I would this kid over here at 750 because he has no history.
Is that a tier two?
I want to see data. Tier two, yeah. Tier two is typically between 680 and 720. Tier three is 620 to 680. You get below 620, we just call that hit the door.
So, <Don't even come.
laughs> I'm just kidding. That's considered tier four. I mean, you're getting into a special asset credit. Anything under 620 right now is considered special asset credit. So you're going to have to go to a lender that's going to do special credit.
Is that like the pawn shop or what?
Pawn shop. It's a pawn shop for lenders. You're going to have to go to a company that will offer subpar loans like that. So your rate's going to be a lot higher.
Sure.
Your origination fee is going to be a lot higher. And it's sad because they punish you for having a bad credit score. And they're the ones that they can't afford it the most.
Yeah.
So they're the ones struggling. And it's just sad. It's the day and age we live in.
It went a little long. So we're going to pick it up from here next week in part two. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.